of his day doing each of these things? Because somebody might object here by saying that, well, what about the other hours that remain? So these probably are a reference to, simply reference to the divisions of the day that a man should make, not necessarily specifically an hour. Thank you for joining us here on Hadith of the Day. We were looking at the enjoyment of self-scrutiny in the words of the Holy Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi wa sallam. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Dr. Shiraz Hossein Agha for the program Hadith of the Day on RIB English Radio.
اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد
Spotlight. Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
It is the first anniversary of Operation Al-Quds Sword, which was launched last year by resistance groups of the Gaza Strip against Israel. Head of the Political Bureau of the Palestinian Hamas Resistance Movement, Ismail Haniyeh, has said that the operation opened a new chapter in the fight against the occupying regime of Israel. In this edition of the Spotlight, we will look at in what ways this new chapter has been opened and why conclusions have been made that Israel has become weaker and more vulnerable. Let's find out more about this from first, our correspondent Ashraf Shannon, who joins us from Gaza City. Ashraf Shannon, welcome. We know that this anniversary is being marked, and of course, Ismail Haniyeh has spoken. Tell us more about what he has said and basically what other officials perhaps have expressed on this anniversary.
Well, Kaveh, Hamas's political bureau chief addressed the masses in Gaza who were commemorating the first anniversary of the Sword of Al-Quds battle in reference to the 11-day war back in May 2021. Basically, Mr. Haniyeh issued a strong warning to the Israeli regime regarding the so-called flag march, which is supposed to take place on the 29th of May. And he also hailed the Palestinian resistance. Palestinian officials today also talked about the increasing might of the Palestinian resistance military wings and also the weakness of the Israeli regime. We've seen during 2021 for the first time Hamas's Izzuddin Qassam brigades initiating the war against the Israeli regime in retaliation for the desecration of the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in Al-Quds and also the threats of evicting the Palestinian Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood in Al-Quds. Also, during that war, we saw the failure of the multi-billion dollar Iron Dome missile intercepting system that failed to intercept thousands of rockets that were fired from Gaza, Kaveh.
Thank you for that. We appreciate it. Ashraf Shannon, our correspondent there from Gaza City, many thanks for that. Let's now introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Joining us is Charlotte Cates, International Coordinator of the Samidun Palestinian Prisoners Solidarity Network, who joins us from Vancouver. Also joining us is Laith Marouf, activist and political commentator, who joins us from Beirut.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines. featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Well, welcome to you both. Charlotte Cates, let me first start with you. We know this operation is the anniversary that was marked today called Al-Quds Sword, executed by the resistance groups from the Gaza Strip. But if you can perhaps give us a check as to why this operation was launched and the reasons behind it, which made the resistance groups to react when they did.
Well, this action by the resistance, this, you know, Battle of Saif al-Quds, was a response, a fundamentally defensive response to the ongoing attacks of Zionist forces, the attempts to continue the ethnic cleansing and eradication of Palestinians in Jerusalem, in Sheikh Jarrah and elsewhere, the ongoing attacks on Al-Aqsa Mosque, which we see continuing to this day, and I mean, just the ongoing daily assault of colonization for over 74 years, mass incarceration, land confiscation, home demolitions, extrajudicial killings, assassinations. I mean, the denial of Palestinian refugees' right to return for the past 74 years. And the Palestinian resistance responded to the calls of their fellow Palestinian sisters and brothers in Jerusalem and throughout occupied Palestine and in exile and diaspora, and responded to engage in the confrontation to defend Palestinians as a whole people, not in, you know, separate categories based on their location, but as one people to defend Palestinians against colonization. And in the process of doing so, the resistance showed in many ways that despite the, you know, over $3.8 billion that the occupation receives every year from the United States and this ongoing and unlimited backing of the imperialist powers in support of the occupation, that it is in effect a crumbling system, a crumbling regime that can really be threatened very seriously by the growing power of the resistance. Mm-hmm. And this is something that was seen by everyone around the world. It came hand in hand with what we call, you know, the Unity Intifada, this uprising of people throughout occupied Palestine, showing that popular resistance and armed resistance are one Palestinian struggle for liberation.
Well, Laith Maruf, Ismail Haniyeh, the Hamas head of political bureau, has said that Al-Quds Sword operation was a turning point in the fight against the Zionist enemy. And this part is what has been highlighted, and it has opened a new and different chapter in that fight. Tell us why Laith Maruf, he has made that statement, and does it go with what our guest there, Charlotte Cates, has said, where the Israeli regime is a crumbling entity in terms of the strength that it used to have, perhaps?
Well, for sure, the Battle of Al-Quds showed a change in all the military balance in the war in Palestine, and we saw clearly that the Israelis couldn't last 11 days and requested this end of hostilities. And unfortunately, the Zionists haven't learned anything from that lesson yet. And we see today the Israeli court that just accepted and approved that Zionists can go on to the Haram al-Sharif, the holy sanctuary, and desecrate it and conduct prayers in front of the Aqsa Mosque and the Dome of the Rock. So what we saw last year may be repeated very fast right now, approaching even before the march of flags, as they call it, the Zionists. In the next few days, we may see a return to hostilities. And it would be now a clear example of what the balance of power has changed to. The rockets that were used in the last war by the resistance in Gaza were only its old stock. They didn't use any of the guided missiles that they have. Much of the drone power of the resistance hasn't been used either in the last war, and none of the axis of resistance actors directly got involved in the battle on the ground in Palestine. If the Zionists didn't learn that lesson, the rest of the world who have mental capabilities to calculate what just happened on the ground in Palestine last year have clearly understood that, and we may see a return to these hostilities in the next few days because of the Zionist arrogance.
Well, Charlotte Cates, when you take a look at what has happened, it almost mirrors, in terms of the, somewhat mirrors what happened last year, what happened this year, in terms of the holy month of Ramadan and the way that Al-Aqsa was desecrated, and the way that the Israel used heavy-handed tactics against Palestinians. And we could add to that some other developments, or at the time, things that happened, such as that incident in Tel Aviv, for example, where even the Israeli security apparatus came out, and one of their chiefs had said that, yes, our security is actually weakened. But they put that in the context where we were not as cautious as we should be. Do you believe that the Israel security apparatus is weakened at this point, combined with what happened last year?
Well, it certainly is. And I think one of the incidents that shows this the most clearly is the escape or the self-liberation of the six Palestinian prisoners through what's been called the Freedom Tunnel, when six Palestinian prisoners, through using the very limited implements available to them, including, you know, metal spoons and their own ingenuity, created a tunnel outside of one of the most highly guarded, reportedly maximum security Israeli occupation prisons holding Palestinian political prisoners. And when these six prisoners liberated themselves and obtained their freedom, even if only for a short time, they didn't just obtain freedom for themselves and show that Palestinians have a will to obtain freedom despite everything. They also indicated just how weak the previously viewed as impenetrable security of the Israeli prison regime really is. And so just today, when the occupation states sentenced them to, you know, five additional years on the top of the already lengthy sentences that they're serving as people who are being imprisoned for their role in the Palestinian resistance, they made it clear that they are quite proud of their actions, because this sentence is essentially a form of revenge for exposing the weaknesses and fragility of the security state when confronted with the dedication and commitment of the resistance.
I'm wondering, at one point, Laith Maruf, can we say that Israel really needs to reassess the way that it is treating Palestinians, desecrating, for example, their holy places like Al-Aqsa, and of course all the other core issues that constitute violation of Palestinian rights? I mean, taking a look at last year, we're looking at how the resistance groups, they revealed their new weapons technology. They struck everywhere inside the 1948 territories. Israeli airports were on lockdown, I believe, though temporarily, and also showing the way that the rockets penetrated everywhere. Obviously, that needs to put a reassessment outlook for Israel. But why do they continue down this failed practice of what an apartheid regime actually does?
Well, it may sound or look like it's illogical what the Zionists are doing, but the reality of the matter is the tactical options open for the Zionists to achieve their strategic goal of dominance, colonization, and you know, projecting their control over the region is the only options that are available out there to them are either suicide or you know, genocidal. So what we mean by that is that if the Zionists do not assert their dominance by force of genocide, and as we saw the assassination of Shirin Abu Akleh last week, then they look weak, and the Palestinians will rise up more and will achieve more of their rights. And if the Zionists actually use force, just like in the case of Shirin Abu Akleh again, in such ways, it actually leads to more Palestinians also rising up. So all the options that are left to the Zionists are negative to them, and they are in a race with time, which is a race that you can't win. The end of Zionism and it's the colony is nearer than ever. We see it near and they see it far, as we say in Arabic. And they have no options left. So we will see more and more of this, what looks like erratic, irrational actions by the Zionists. And we all have to be ready for them in Palestine and in the region, in the axis of resistance. And this is true on a general scale and on a global scale as the empire starts to crumble and as we see it flagging left and right in the war in Ukraine and the increased pressure on China and Iran, and the assassination just happened today in the streets of Iran of an Iranian officer that served to protect the holy sites in Syria. So here we have another Zionist action that may look very irrational, but that's the only options that are left to them, and the resistance has to be ready to respond in full force because there's no option to us either.
So if we were to take a look at the ways that what has been categorized as an apartheid regime by many rights organizations, Charlotte Cates, the way that it's moving forward, it's jeopardizing its own security even more. And, of course, the assassination of Shireen Abu Akleh, perhaps like no other time, has really put the spotlight on Israel. One thing that's not really talked about much is how from within Israel is not that stable. Politically speaking, I believe that they don't have a coalition that is in effect anymore at this point. They don't have the majority. And also the plight of many Israelis, they've opted to migrate out of Israel. Is that another way of looking at the Israeli regime and the way that it has weakened?
Well, there is an ongoing crisis within the settler colonial project. And it's a settler colonial project that is maintained in a constant state of war and aggression against the Palestinian people, the Arab people, and the entire region. And so it's a hostile project that's backed by imperialism, and that's the reason for its existence. And so obviously that is never going to be a stable project that is a normal state having a normal experience. Now, there are these, you know, constant kind of conflicts and contradictions within the Zionist political parties and within the Zionist framework. And one of the things that we far too often see in this context is that we see the Zionist parties competing with one another for how much they want to kill and repress and imprison Palestinians. And so you see the election campaigning within the Zionist state is done at the expense of the Palestinian people. And that's why it is so important to talk about the growing strength of the resistance. And that comes hand in hand. That growing strength of the resistance comes hand in hand with the growing realization and recognition, not just by popular movements, but even by institutions and rights institutions around the world, of the ongoing war crimes and crimes against humanity perpetuated by the Zionist project against the Palestinian people. This kind of competing in elections over the exploitation and oppression of Palestinians is something that should draw horror from people around the world. And of course, in addition, there is the fact that that the Palestinian people inside occupied Palestine 48, who have had the Israeli citizenship imposed upon them, have been very active in organizing and protesting and resisting colonization in the Nakba, in resisting colonization throughout occupied Palestine 48, in participating in the Unity Intifada and the uprising throughout occupied Palestine from the river to the sea. And this also includes, you know, the growing and revival of the calls to completely boycott the Knesset elections and reject these systems that are put in place solely to maintain the settler colonial project. So just like any kind of colonial project like this that is installed in a hostile manner to the people, of course, it's always going to be a fragile colonial institution, both internally and externally.
Laith Maruf, if we are looking at the calculations that Israel makes, at this point, you said that, you know, they are making the same mistakes again. What is the possibility of them attacking the Gaza Strip? I mean, we're looking at, for example, how this spate of incidents that happened in the month of Ramadan, based on records, marked the deadliest period of attacks in Israel since the year 2006. Do you think that Israel can afford to even wage another war? Because at this point, given all the different things that have happened during the month of Ramadan, which we just skimmed over, and of course topping that would be the assassination of Shireen Abu Akleh, that the world would then really turn against Israel were they to wage a war?
Well, truly, this is where we have to understand that the Zionist project is a pillar of imperialism. It's there's a huge difference, for instance, between South Africa during its apartheid years and the Zionist project right now. One is that the South African apartheid system was not a pillar of imperial projection of power. Without the existence of a Zionist colony, the United States in its empire cannot project power towards much of Asia and Africa. And therefore, we have to be very realistic and understand that there will be no change in the position of any of the components of the empire, including the European states and states like, colonies like Canada and Australia and New Zealand, towards the Zionists, except after their defeat. They will not come to the aid of the Palestinian people, even if every citizen in Canada, in the United States, in Europe already is anti-Zionist. Those states will not change their position, their existence as dominators over much of Africa and Asia is hinged on this project. And therefore, the continuity of hostilities are at the core of the projection forward. The Zionists have no choice but to create more death and more genocide and create more hostilities towards its neighbors, because they cannot exist without that. And all of us in the region here should be ready for those realities constantly. And I think much of the axis of resistance in its military forces, in Hezbollah, in Hamas, in Islamic Jihad, in the PLFP, in Iran, in Syria, in Iraq, in Yemen, are aware of that reality, and we should prepare our audience for that too.
Charlotte Cates, what do you think? Do you agree?
I think that it is very important to stand with and support the Palestinian resistance and the resistance throughout the region and the camp of resistance around the world. Every day we're seeing ongoing resistance to the imperial order, and we see this from Cuba to Venezuela to Iran to Yemen to Palestine. We see an ongoing resistance to the imperial order on military, financial, and political levels that is growing around the world. And so the Palestinian struggle is part and parcel of that anti-imperialist resistance. There is so much organizing and struggle that is also taking place even within the imperialist countries. Of course, it is the Palestinian resistance and the resistance of the Arab people and the people of the region who will obtain the victory. But it's so important to take action, to do everything that we can to put a stop to this ongoing imperial crimes that are being committed against the Palestinian people and the people of the region and the world. This is why we're seeing things like in Berlin, where just last week, three demonstrations commemorating the Palestinian Nakba were banned. Over 170 people were arrested by the police, and there's this attempt to impose essentially a police state on the Palestinian and Arab community and on anti-imperialist activists in Berlin because of the fact that the German state no longer feels confident in its ability to freely and openly maintain its ongoing collaboration in war crimes and crimes against humanity in occupied Palestine and elsewhere around the world. This is not just a one-off situation of a violation of rights taking place in one country. This is a symptom of the fact that the movement in support of the Palestinian people, in support of the Palestinian resistance, in support of Palestinian liberation from the river to the sea is growing everywhere, okay, including in the heart of the imperialist and settler colonial powers.
Thank you very much. Unfortunately, we're fresh out of time. Charlotte Cates there, International Coordinator, Semidun Palestinian Prisoner Solidarity Network. Laith Maruf, thank you. Activist and political commentator from Beirut. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Tahway and the team, it's goodbye until next time.
Insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
In the name of Allah, the Compassionate, the Merciful, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu Alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program, Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom. Please stay with us. أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين In the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. Dear listeners, hello everyone. Welcome to another edition of the program Insights into the Holy Quran. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, and in this edition, we will try to have a closer look at the 25th chapter, Surah Al-Furqan. First, let's just listen to the verses we're going to talk about in this program, and we'll be back shortly. So stay with us.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim.
In the name of Allah, the entirely merciful, the especially merciful.
وَهُوَ الَّذِي جَعَلَ اللَّيْلَ وَالنَّهَارَ خِلْفَةً لِمَنْ أَرَادَ أَنْ يَذَّكَّرَ أَوْ أَرَادَ شُكُورًا
And it is he who has made the night and the day in succession for whoever desires to remember or desires gratitude.
The 62nd verse of this chapter says, وَهُوَ الَّذِي جَعَلَ اللَّيْلَ وَالنَّهَارَ خِلْفَةً لِمَنْ أَرَادَ أَنْ يَذَّكَّرَ أَوْ أَرَادَ شُكُورًا And he it is who has made the night and the day to succeed each other for him who desires to reflect or desires to be thankful. As you have been previously with us, dear listeners, the previous verses were talking about the pretext-seeking of the disbelievers that when it was told to them that you should prostrate to Rahman, the Beneficent Allah, they said, what is Rahman? We don't know Rahman, the Beneficent Allah, and we are not going to prostrate to what you, the Prophet, are bidding us. In answer to their pretext, the Holy Quran answered very seriously in the 61st verse, تَبَارَكَ الَّذِي جَعَلَ فِي السَّمَاءِ بُرُوجًا He blessed is he who has set in heavens the constellations, and he has set a lamp and the moon illuminating. So, in answer to their pretext seeking, the Holy Quran mentioned the different symbols of Almighty Allah's power and omnipotence on the earth. And now, this noble verse still continues to introduce the Lord of the universe, and this verse states another part of the system of the existence. It says, وَهُوَ الَّذِي جَعْلَ اللَّيْلَ وَالنَّهَارَ خِلْفَةً. He it is who has made the night and the day to succeed each other. لِمَنْ أَرَادَ أَنْ يَذَّكَّرَ أَوْ أَرَادَ شُكُورًا. For him who desires to reflect or desires to be thankful.
على مر الزمان تألقا وأضاء للدنيا طريقا.
We hope and pray that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blesses us with the ability to cover more of His divine
In this
word.
Series of programs, we will inshallah discuss the Holy Quran with a thematic
approach. We will inshallah discuss the chapter.
تعلقا وتلاه في جنح الدجى متدبرا.
The context in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala speaks in this verse is the context of mentioning the ills and problems and evils of the people of the book, the previous nations who have received revelation, and more particularly the Jew.
Now let's listen to some of the verses of the Holy Quran.
First, let's listen to a few verses.
Now let's listen to some verses of the Holy Quran.
Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom.
It is the regular system that rules the day and the night, which alternatively substitute each other. This system is in work and has been for millions of years, and it is the system that if does not exist, the life of man will be destroyed by intensity of heat and light, or maybe darkness. And this is an attractive reason for those who want to know Allah. The interesting part of the verse, I assume, is where it says, لِمَنْ أَرَادَ أَنْ يَذَّكَّرْ. For the one who desires to reflect. So, the people's will, their intentions, are the main and starting reason if they want to reach salvation. They have to intend for it themselves, or else no one can make them reach salvation. No one can make them step in the right path. It is up to themselves to choose this way. So the human beings, they are all created free to choose right from wrong. Anyway, we know that the system of day and night is generated from the movement of the earth around its gradual and regular changes, and the fact that duration of one of them increases and the other one decreases. This is causing for a year to create four seasons. If the earth rotated faster or slower than its usual speed, in one case, the nights would get so longer that all things would be frozen. And in other case, the days would be so long that the sun would burn everything. Moreover, this centrifugal force could be so intense that the earthly creatures could be thrown out into the space. But although the earth is moving this fast,
but it does not throw anyone out into the space. We all think it is state and firm. In brief, on one hand, the study of this system awakens the theology nature in man. Perhaps the application of the phrase desires to reflect, as I mentioned, is referring to this fact. And on the other hand, it somehow awakens the thanksgiving spirit in man. And the phrase desires to be thankful might be referring to this matter. At the end, I assume it is worth mentioning one narration from one of the infallibles that has a very specific point of view regarding the succession of day and night. He says, coming day and night in succession is for the matter that if man does dereliction of his duties in one of them, he recompenses it in another one. And this meaning, dear listeners, might be the second commentary for the verse. And since the verses of the Holy Quran have got different levels of meaning, it is not somehow inconsistent with the first commentary we mentioned early on. Thank you, brothers and sisters, for staying with us in this program. We have got some other points to mention regarding this 62nd verse of this chapter that we will, God willing, talk about them later on. We ask the Almighty Allah to set us among the guided ones and the people of the straight path. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets. This life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also visit our website at parstoday.com. Until the next program, take care.
Things always worked for me, worry, and that's when faith begins.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,865 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Puraza, London.
Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
A new list released by British Daily, The Sunday Times, says there are a record number of billionaires in the UK, with the richest 250 people worth more than half a trillion pounds. Released in the middle of a soaring cost of living crisis, this year's list has new entrants, among them a UK government minister and his wife.
The UK, home to some of the richest people on the planet. The capital, London, alone has more billionaires than any other city in the world. That's all according to UK Daily, The Sunday Times' rich list. In this country, it says, 250 people now own a combined $886 billion, enough to lift millions out of extreme poverty several times over.
It clearly shows that the capitalist system is not working. And obviously, we are celebrating that there are so many more millionaires who have more than doubled or tripled their wealth in the last 2 years, while the poor have become really even poorer.
Many of the names on the list have been there for years. This year, though, two new faces. Chancellor Rishi Sunak, the man in charge of helping millions of struggling British families through the spiraling cost of living crisis, and his wife.
Evidently, someone of his wealth has no understanding of the crisis that a majority of the people are facing. We have 4 million people going to food banks, and the crisis, the cost of living crisis, is becoming very significant. By the end of the year, the ordinary people, the poorer sections of the community, may be even in more difficulty, while Mr. Rishi Sunak is laughing all the way to the bank.
The bulk of Rishi Sunak's wealth stems from his wife, the daughter of an Indian IT mogul. He also made his fortune working for Goldman Sachs and as a hedge fund manager in the past. We wanted to know how Britons felt about their chancellor now being one of the 250 wealthiest people in the country, amidst the cost of living crisis that's pushing millions of people into poverty.
I believe it's not fair, particularly the way we found out, suddenly, out of the blue.
I don't feel particular resentment at people who have money, as long as they do their job and do their job well. No one would have known had not it been highlighted recently.
First published in 1989, the Sunday Times rich list bears the names of 1,000 ultra-rich people or families resident in the United Kingdom. 90% of those on the list are usually men.
At a time of record inflation, when many are struggling with energy bills, petrol prices and food costs, this golden era for the UK's super-rich, among them now a government official, does not seem to be coming to an end. Saeed Purizep, London.
U.S. President Joe Biden met South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol for summit talks in Seoul Saturday. The conservative Yoon seeks to strengthen the U.S.-South Korea alliance. Biden's remarks perhaps fell short of the strategic nuclear umbrella the hawkish Yoon seeks, while offering some reassurance regarding North Korea's missile and nuclear programs.
Today, President Yoon and I committed to strengthening our close engagement and work together to take on challenges of regional security, including addressing the threat posed by the Democratic People's Republic of Korea, by further strengthening our deterrence posture and working toward a complete denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula.
Several demonstrations took place throughout the day outside the summit venue. Peace activists worry Yoon's hasty actions to embrace Washington endanger regional peace and security.
Strengthening the U.S.-South Korea alliance will likely cause a backlash from North Korea, China, and Russia and destabilize the security of South Korea. If we jump on the U.S. strategy too easily,
Will this really protect the economy and security of South Korea?
Presidents Yoon and Biden also toured a Samsung Electronics factory. Biden plans to launch the Indo-Pacific Economic Framework in Tokyo next week as the U.S. implements the new trade grouping largely aimed at containing China. South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol is just 10 days into his five-year term in office. Through this summit with U.S. President Joe Biden, Seoul has now strongly pivoted to a more pro-American foreign policy. The question then is how U.S. adversaries in the region, China and North Korea, will react. Frank Smith, Seoul.
Outrage has spread across the pro-Palestine community this week after British Home Secretary Priti Patel branded the boycott, divestment and sanctions movement racist and anti-Semitic. The controversial comments were issued on Monday at a Conservative Friends of Israel lobby group event.
The BDS movement, everything we have seen around the BDS movement is racist. The anti-Semitic troops, the cartoons, the chants.
Founded in 2005, the BDS movement is a Palestinian-led campaign promoting boycott and economic sanctions against Israel. After a notable rise in popularity and success in recent years, the British establishment has acted to essentially criminalise the practice. In response to Patel's comments, onlookers have pointed out her own policies and praise of Israel's ambassador as blatant hypocrisy.
The hypocrisy of Priti Patel calling anyone or anything racist on one hand, whilst openly gushing for Tzipi Hotovli on the other. I mean, Tzipi is an out-and-out anti-Arab racist. She thinks that Jews and Arabs should have no relationships at all. She also thinks that the Nakba, the expulsion of 700,000 Palestinians at the birth of Israel, she thinks that was a myth. Secondly, Priti Patel herself, her comments against Black Lives Matter, against English footballers who took the knee against in solidarity against racism, and also the laws that she's brought into place, like the Nationality and Borders Act. These comments, these laws, they've further, deeper structuralised racism into British society.
In addition to the anti-BDS remarks, Patel laid bare her so-called unflinching support to Israel. This comes just days after the shock killing of Palestinian journalist Shireen Abu Akhila by Israeli regime forces, making it appear that no matter what crimes are being committed, Tel Aviv can rely on unwavering support from the British Home Office. Robert Carter, London.
On Friday, about 2,000 people staged a rally in the Italian capital calling on the Mario Draghi government and the EU to stop sending weapons to Kyiv and finally promote peace talks to resolve the war in Ukraine. The initiative had been called by a number of base unions and supported by a string of leftist movements. People at the rally expressed high concern over the serious military escalation by all parties involved in the Ukraine conflict.
The EU is not acting right. Its wary posture has only put one bloc against another. The people are those who will suffer from our rulers' decisions in the end.
There are too many conflicting interests at stake, and Italy is far too servile. The EU should do more. I don't support Putin, but I'm also against Zelensky. He is not acting in the interests of the Ukrainians.
Following the start of the conflict in Ukraine, Italy has opted to gradually cut its gas reliance on Russia. Rome has been importing gas from Moscow for over 50 years, and about 45% of its total demand is provided by Russia.
I'm a small retailer. I was forced to close down during the COVID, but I haven't seen a cent of support from the government. And now they spend billions for the war. When will they look after us?
Undoubtedly, the Italian government is far too aligned with NATO, but it's not just that. The government is very much distant from the people, as surveys show the majority of the Italians are against the war.
Since the start of the conflict, opinion polls have steadily shown half of the Italians oppose the sending of weapons to Ukraine and believe sanctions against Russia are useless. About one-fifth of the surveyed Italians have so far said they are in support of the Draghi government's delivery of heavy weapons to Kyiv. The conflict in Ukraine, its dire consequences, and the fear it could spread or go on for a long time are not the only worries Italians are concerned with. Rising inflation, a growing cost of energy, blocked salaries, continual crumbling of purchasing power, all economic indicators are pointing towards a recession. Many expect the country to be faced with a hot autumn of strikes and protests. Max Civili, Rome.
A UK-based Israeli arms manufacturer has been hit with a series of disruptive direct action protests in retaliation to recent Israeli aggression against Palestinians. Palestine Action have intensified their long-running campaign against Elbit Systems, with activists trashing sites in London and Bristol.
Elbit Systems is a notorious Israeli arms manufacturer with locations dotted all across the UK. Their HQ, located just behind me, is a popular target for Palestine Action, who claim that their activities is focused on disrupting their production activities. Elbit is known for producing up to 85% of Israel's drone fleet, after all.
Israeli crimes against Palestinians has circulated world headlines in recent weeks, particularly surrounding the killing of journalist Shireen Abu Akhila, shot dead by Israeli regime forces as she documented an Israeli assault on a Palestinian refugee camp on the 11th of May. The killing occurred just days before the Nakba, an annual date which marks the ethnic cleansing of native Palestinians from their homeland. Elbit's recent response stated,
Elbit Systems UK is proud to provide advanced support for the UK armed forces. Attempting to disrupt this work during a time of heightened global instability is dangerous and highly irresponsible.
However, speaking to Press TV, the activists rubbish Elbit's stance.
How many lives have they saved compared to how many lives they've taken, would be my question. They are responsible for so many deaths of men, women and children. How could you possibly think that that's in any way security? It's illegal, it's a crime. All of these things are criminal, and yet it's when you're out there doing something that you're shown as the criminal, essentially. And I've always found that very interesting as a narrative.
With Palestine Action vowing to continue and Israel's occupation persisting, many expect to see more spilling of red paint, but also more Palestinian blood too. Robert Carter, London.
Once again, crimes committed by the Israeli regime have been debated in the European Parliament. Lawmakers condemned the brutal murder on the 11th of May of Palestinian journalist Shireen Abu Akhla. She was shot in the head by an Israeli soldier.
Too often we, here in Europe, look away when the spiral of violence continues, when new settlements, plans are announced, or when another journalist gets killed or wounded.
Clearly wearing press attire, 51-year-old Abu Akhla was murdered in cold blood while covering an Israeli military raid in the occupied West Bank city of Jenin. During her funeral, Israeli forces attacked mourners.
The European Union is appalled by the events that took place during the funeral procession. The EU condemned this disproportionate use of force and disrespectful behaviour.
Western media and Western leaders have been accused of turning a blind eye to the international law violations continuously perpetrated by the apartheid Israeli regime in the occupied territories.
Increased settler violence around the settlements, clashes at the holy sites in Jerusalem during the Ramadan, forced evictions and demolitions in the West Bank, including of EU-funded projects.
Tel Aviv has been urged to fully cooperate with an independent inquiry into Shireen's murder. The EU says that's important in order to maintain the bloc's close partnership with Israel.
When situations like this arise, we say it is very important for this partnership to continue in its high quality, that we have clarity about things that are happening which are actually against our principles and our values.
EU legislators urge the West not to give up on the idea of a two-state solution to end the Israel-Palestine conflict.
The tragic death of Shireen Abu Akhla is a sad reminder of the spiral of violence taking place that continues to haunt this region.
The European Parliament debate heard that Israel has killed around 50 Palestinian journalists during the past two decades. It goes without saying, then, that Shireen was not the first, and almost certainly will not be the last. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Months after the Taliban takeover of Afghanistan, the U.S. Special Inspector General for Afghanistan Reconstruction, or SIGAR, confessed that Washington was mainly to blame for the collapse of the former Afghan government and national security and defense forces. The report by SIGAR reveals that Afghan forces' morale were destroyed after then-U.S. President Donald Trump reached a deal with the Taliban in 2020, and President Joe Biden affirmed the U.S. withdrawal in 2021.
In my opinion, the Doha deal paved the way for the U.S.-led foreign forces' withdrawal from Afghanistan. It also gave the Taliban forces the belief that they can take over Afghanistan easily. In fact, the Doha deal and the U.S. withdrawal both were great achievements for the Taliban and Afghanistan.
Former Afghan generals and experts also told the agency that most American support to Afghan forces was stopped or limited, while the Taliban had intensified attacks.
I agree with the SIGAR report. The former Afghan Republic government was defeated when the U.S. signed a deal with the Taliban. After the Doha deal, the U.S. stopped its major logistic support, including fuel, rockets, arms, and air support to Afghan forces. It continued until the Afghan army completely ran out of equipment.
SIGAR notes that in essence, U.S. and Afghan efforts to cultivate an effective and sustainable security assistance sector were likely to fail from the beginning. Afghan experts also say that the U.S. never meant to build a nation or a state in the country, and all Western-backed armies are doomed to failure.
The former Afghan government was an example of American state-building. They invaded our country, formed their own government, and finally demolished it. They never meant to boost the state-nation process. The Americans appointed their own men to the Afghan government, while they were not representing Afghan people. In addition, the U.S. intentionally established a corrupt and dependent army in Afghanistan.
The Taliban took over Afghanistan in August 2021 as the U.S. and its allies hastily abandoned Afghanistan and the former Western-backed government collapsed. Afghans are angry with the U.S. for pushing Afghanistan into a dire situation. People here believe Washington not only betrayed Afghans but also continues to harm them with sanctions. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
In Indian-controlled Kashmir, a recent order by the authorities is giving sleepless nights to many business owners and shopkeepers. Business owners, big and small, are spending hundreds of dollars each to install security cameras, a mandatory move ordered by the authorities. The official order says the scheme will deter criminals, antisocial and anti-national elements. The order also outlines the minimum standards for camera resolution, infrared capability and range. The government's order has been highly criticized by business owners. They describe the move as a callous approach towards warrior-y Kashmir's fractured business establishments, which were deeply dented after India cancelled Kashmir's semi-autonomous status in August 2019.
Everybody knows the quantum of the business, it's almost 80% down. It was their duty to install the CC camera. Why to tell to the business you install the CCTV cameras? You see, the 80% of the business company, they cannot afford to install this CCTV camera. So I think they should review this decision and they should look into this.
Muzaffar Jan, a shop owner in the heart of Srinagar's busiest market, Lal Chowk, says it has been days since he has seen a customer at his store. However, to follow the police instructions, he was forced to pull out the money he had saved for running his household.
I waited for around a week to see whether others would install cameras. Later, I was forced because of continuous announcements and strict orders. I installed the camera. It took me around $1,000, and not everyone can afford this cost. In Kashmir, there are frequent power cuts, and to keep the camera plugged in, I had to install an uninterrupted power supply inverter. Many of us can't manage two meals a day. How can we afford these cameras?
The order further instructs that the cameras installed at the business owner's expense must always stay on. The system should record and store footage for 30 days and must be produced on demand of police and other law enforcement agencies without any court order. And failure to abide by the order will result in a fine or month-long imprisonment. The level of surveillance in Kashmir is increasing day by day. Authorities argue that the measure will help them protect people's lives. But Kashmiris are calling the move as a worrying development and see it as a threat to their human rights, privacy and dignity. Shahana Butt, Indian administered Kashmir.